The reading is Hebrews 2:1-18. We must pay more attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. For if the message spoken by the angels was binding, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment, how shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him. God also testified to it by signs, wonders, and various miracles, and gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will. Jesus made like his brothers. It is not to angels that he has subjected the world to come about which we are speaking, but there is a place where someone has testified. What is man that you are mindful of him? The Son of Man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet. In putting everything under his feet, God left nothing that is not subject to him. Yet at present we do not see everything subject to him. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. Both the one who makes men holy and those who are made holy are the same family. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers. He says, I will declare your name to my brothers in the presence of the congregation. I will sing your praises. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, he says, here I am, and the children of God has given me. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted.
Thanks very much, Josie. This year, Jill and I were fortunate enough to get out a little bit in Europe in our car on a bit of a holiday, and we spent a week in the Black Forest. I don't know whether you've ever been to the Black Forest, but it's not as it sounds, black. And it's not all forest. But there are an awful lot of farms there. Huge number of farms. And we were staying in a farmhouse. And we had fields behind us, as far as the eye could see, and fields on the other side of the road. It was amazing. And the weather was good. And it was sunny, and it was warm, and the grass was high as this. And this is the grass that they need to cut down for winter food for the animals. And unfortunately, in the middle of the week, they forecasted rain for the weekend. And so obviously the farmers got it in their heads that they needed to harvest all this grass. And so they started panic stations. There were tractors everywhere. They were tractoring. They were directing tractors. They were baling. These wonderful machines they've got for putting grass in bales have to be seen to be believed. You know, they go in, sort of bits of grass, and come out wrapped, a bit like a loaf. really, quite big loaves, mind you, and then they had to transport them to the different farms. They just managed it, just in time, before the deluge came. Now, I don't know whether you know this, probably don't, I didn't. In the Old Testament, there are 49 references to harvest. One of the things the Israelites were told by God to do when they were at Mount Sinai, just coming out in the Exodus, was to have 3 annual celebrations. The first was the Festival of Unleavened Bread, leading to the Passover in March, April time. And the other two were harvests. They had 2 harvests. The first one was the Festival of Harvest, which is called today Pentecost, or in Hebrew Shavuot. And that was for the first crops and the first fruits. And then they had another one called the Festival of the Final Harvest, or the Ingathering, or Tabernacles, or Shelters, they were also called. Today it's called Sukkot. So they had 2 harvests in Israel, or in the wilderness. They were supposed to celebrate there, but of course they didn't grow crops at that point because they didn't have their land. So 49 references in the Old Testament. How many do you think there are in the New Testament? Well, the answer is 14. Just 14 references. And Jesus mentions the harvest in all 4 Gospels. And that's 13 of them. And there's 1 reference to the harvest in Revelation. That's all. But there is a big difference. The ones in the Old Testament refer to the physical harvest, the literal gathering in of crops. But the New Testament ones, in every single case, refers to the spiritual harvest, or the metaphorical harvest, if you want to call it that. In Matthew chapter 9, Jesus talks about the lack of workers to tend the fields. And here he's talking about going out and spreading the good news. That's what he's referring to. That's the harvest, the seed being planted. And in Matthew 13, he talks about the wheat, the good seed, which he has planted, and the weeds, which have been planted by the devil. And they grow together, side by side, until the harvest. And Jesus tells us quite clearly, the harvest, which is the end of the world. That's when harvest, the spiritual harvest, will actually take place at the end of the world, and it will be carried out by the angels. And in Revelation chapter 14, this is actually pictured for us. We see it taking place in advance of it actually happening, in picture form. And Jesus is seated in majesty on his throne, and the angels are given the command by Jesus to go out and gather in the crops ready for judgment. And this theme is taken up in the Great Harvest Hymn, which we'll be singing at the end of our service tonight, "Come, ye thankful people, come." You all know that. And Henry Alford, who wrote it, actually pictures the glorious harvest of souls at the end of the world in that song. It was written, by the way, in 1844, and I didn't realise this, in Buckinghamshire. He was the rector of a little church in a place called Aston Sandford, just southwest of Aylesbury, near Tame. I found great trouble finding it on the map, but I did find it eventually. It's a little tiny place. Anyway, a couple of weeks ago we started our series on Hebrews, and tonight we're looking at chapter 2. And what the writer is trying to do in chapter 2 is to encourage us to pay attention to the message of salvation which has been announced by Jesus. In chapter 1, he's already shown how much greater than angels Jesus is. And, you know, if we were to meet an angel, if an angel popped in to our bedroom, like, you know, it happened to Mary and Joseph, you know, at Christmas time, that first Christmas, they were accosted by an angel. You know, I think we'd probably take notice, don't you? I don't think we'd sort of say, "Oh, go away," or something like that. I'm pretty sure that we'd listen. So, what the writer is saying, if you would listen to angels, why don't you listen to Jesus, who is so much greater than the angels? He has proclaimed the good news, so listen to him, is what he's saying. So, our aim as Christians is to be there at the final harvest, and to be those that are gathered in as good seed. We started off as good seed rather than weeds. So, the problem is, it's not an easy ride for us. The devil and the world are trying constantly to unseat us and to divert us. He talks here about drifting in dangerous currents of water. We're being swept this way and swept that way. So the writer picks out four particular facts in this chapter which can help us run the marathon race that we're all involved in and will help us get to the finishing line in one piece. So these are the four ideas. First of all, Jesus, verse 10, is the perfect leader. I know from running a few marathons that one thing that surprised me was that they have group leaders in a marathon. Did you know that? People with big notices strapped themselves saying, with a finishing time, like 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, 24 hours. No, we didn't say anything like that. But so you can attach yourself to a group of runners, and that person's job is to run a nice even pace so that they will, all the people in that group will get there in whatever the time is on his poster, on his chest, or her chest. Not too fast, not too slow, just right. It's also someone to focus on while you're running, along with the other people in the group. And sometimes you're going to need words of encouragement, and in that group you get words of encouragement, and the pacemaker, if we can call him that, you know, during your tricky moments, encourages you. It's not just the cheers from the spectators that keep you going. And I found that when we got to Canary Wharf, devoid of any spectators at all. So you didn't get any encouragement there. You had to wait until you got back into the major roads. So, the writer goes into more detail in chapter 12 about the race that we're involved in. But suffice it to say now that Jesus has initiated the race. He started off the race, and he completed it, and he gives us an example of how to face each part. He is the leader of this race par excellence. He blazed the trail for us with focus and endurance, and as we read and reread the Gospels and his word, we are motivated to live more like him, because he's our leader, and we all know that we follow our leader. So that's the first thing. He's the perfect leader. Secondly, he's the perfect elder brother. Verse 11. When we began this race ourselves as individuals, we gave our lives in trust to God. And then he did a wonderful thing. He adopted us into his family as sons and daughters, as Paul puts it in Romans 8. And now we can call him Abba, Father. That's a word which means daddy. We have this intimate relationship with God. He taught us himself, Jesus, to pray like that, didn't he? Our Father, who is in heaven. So, as Jesus is his son, he is like our elder brother. And he's not ashamed to call us brothers and sisters, we're told in this little passage in chapter 2 of Hebrews. He's one who, like a good elder brother, can come alongside when it's necessary and give us advice and teach us. He teaches us through his Holy Spirit things that we need to know when we're running our race. And we know also this amazing fact that he prays for us as well. He intercedes on our behalf, as Paul puts it. And he's sitting in the place of honour at God's right hand, pleading for us. It's not just a simple prayer. He's pleading with the Father for each one of us to help us to keep going. I didn't have an older brother. I did have an older sister. And when she moved to California, when she was quite young, it wasn't a great wrench for anyone. We didn't have a marvellous relationship. And distance makes the heart grow fonder, as we know. And when I got diabetes, she emailed me to say, "Oh, I'm glad you got it and not me. I knew it would come to our family because my father had it." You know, this is our ongoing relationship. But, you know, I've often thought, what would it be like to have an older brother who kept an eye on me and so on and so forth? But I didn't have that. Perhaps you did. Anyway, Jesus is the perfect elder brother. So he's the perfect leader and he's the perfect elder brother. He's also the perfect sacrifice. In the Old Testament times, the high priest had to continually make sacrifice for sin. For himself, first of all, he couldn't go into the Holy of Holies if he hadn't made a sacrifice of his own sin. And then he had to make a sacrifice for everyone else. And of course we know about the Day of Atonement. Every year there was a Day of Atonement when the nation had this sacrifice made on their behalf. But it never really dealt with the problem of sin. But by becoming flesh and blood himself, when he became a child in a manger, as we think of at Christmas time, Jesus was able, like us, to die, as a human, to die. Now, the devil tried to get rid of him. He tried to starve him in the desert. He tried to get him stoned in the synagogue. He tried to get Herod to kill him when he was just a baby. But no, it wasn't that. It was what Jesus wanted to do was to give his life voluntarily on our behalf. And so by dying in our place, the righteous was killed on behalf of the sinful. And he was able to break the power of the devil. And what's the power of the devil? It's that fear of death. Until Jesus came, there was no reason for anyone not to fear death. Because no one knew really what was going to happen. But now we know. If we trust in him, we're going to heaven. So sin has been dealt with for all time. No more sacrifices are ever needed again. Once for all, a done deal. So Jesus is the perfect sacrifice. But fourthly, lastly, Jesus is the perfect helper. Verse 18. This is the last benefit the writer mentions here. He was like us in every way. He was tempted like us. He had emotional ups and downs, like us. He suffered pain, like us. He was let down by others, like us. He was misunderstood, like us. Yet he never gave in, he never capitulated, he never got it wrong, unlike us. The result, he can help us through all our difficulties because he's been there first. He's been there, he's been through it. He's experienced human life in all its ups and downs and all its complexities. And so he can sympathise with us and help us through our difficulties. So as the writer says at the beginning, our temptation is to be lured away from the narrow pathway that Jesus talked about in Matthew 7. It's only too easy to drift towards the wide pathway where the vast majority of people are happily walking. We saw that only too well when we did our series on the churches in Revelation. So what he says is, we must listen very carefully and be aware of what's important. If we want to be part of that glorious harvest in the end days that Jesus talks about, then we need to make sure that he is our leader, our elder brother, our sacrifice, and our helper, perfectly so in all cases. And if we ensure that he's those things to us, then we will make it to the line and receive the crown he has ready for us. And this crown is described in different ways by the different writers. It's a crown of righteousness, Paul says to Timothy. It's a crown of life, James says. And Peter says it's a crown of glory and honour. All these things will be ours. We'll be in our Father's kingdom forever, where the righteous shine like the sun, we're told in Matthew by Jesus himself. So, that's what we can look forward to if we trust in Jesus, who is so much greater than the angels.